welcome to the Wine Access Unfiltered podcast. I am Amanda McCrossin. We are here for episode 4 of our 4-part mini-series featuring Michelin-starred chefs from across the country and focusing on their cuisines and their cities. And I'm so excited because I get to have with me today first-time co-host but longtime friend, Mr. Eduardo Dingler. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing fantastic. Super thrilled to be here. Super excited to chat with you and chef and drink great wine.
We always drink great wine. That's not new news.
Always.
But I am excited about this particular wine because this is one that you sort of brought to the table, which we'll talk about in just a second. But the other thing that you bring to the table is a lot of experience working with Asian cuisine. You were the global beverage director, right, from Morimoto?
Correct.
Correct. Yeah.
Yes.
Of course, I got to know you out in Napa Valley, and now you're working at Wine Access, but a lot of experience talking about a subject today that we're going to be talking about with our Michelin-starred chef, Chef Min Phan. We're going to be talking about foods from Asian cultures and all of the unique perspectives that they bring, how to pair them with wine, what you can be doing at home. And to do that, Chef, we are delighted to have you. You are such a presence in the LA food scene. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show.
Such an honor to have you both and do this with you. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Eduardo. And I get to drink from a very big glass.
Yes.
That is the proper size, I call it.
We're going to dive deep into what you're doing in LA with Fennekai, with Porridge and Puffs, and your very unique Michelin star in just a second. But before we get there, let's talk about what's going on a little bit in the wine world. Eduardo, we have some sad news that I'm sure you saw just a few days ago. Dick Arath from Arath Winery in Willamette Valley, one of the pioneers of the Willamette Valley, has passed away. Did you see this?
I did see that. I continue to raise a glass for him.
Yes.
Because he was not only a pioneer, but a force behind Oregon, the Oregon wine scene and the U.S. in general. Those wines stand the testament of time, and I'm a huge fan. They always bring good memories.
Me too. Chef, are you a fan of Oregon Pinot Noir?
I am. I've spent some time up there. You know, I think I may have OD'd on Pinot. Then, you know, I'm just re-falling in love with it. I re-fall in love with it when I'm up north.
It's easy to do that, right? Especially when you're in the Willamette Valley. And, you know, that weather just sort of suggests drinking Pinot like all the time. Like, I think the smells there, the feel there. I think what's really interesting about Dick Arath, and I didn't realize, he was a California transplant.
Like many other vintners in Oregon, for sure. He led the trail.
He did. He planted his first vineyards in 1969. In fact, we owe a lot of the Willamette Valley to him. And we talked about him in our Oregon podcast just a few episodes ago. So he will be missed, but his legacy lives on. And we should all be raising a glass to Oregon Pinot and his honor in that way. An update to something we talked about a few episodes ago, Silicon Valley Bank. We all heard about the news. And of course, I mentioned in a previous podcast with Laura that the wine division was affected because, of course, when Silicon Valley was no more, the wine division, which is a very big part of our community in Napa Valley and up into other parts in California and Oregon, was no longer. We didn't know what was going to happen. It's been such a big presence for us. But it looks like they have found a new home in First Citizens Bank and Trust. This does include the wine division. So hopefully that means that we will continue to see those amazing industry wine reports. Hopefully they'll still be a great sounding board for the wineries who were invested with them, who were banking with them, and who leaned on them for a lot of their financial questions and marketing things. I think this is all great news for them. I know that you are friendly with someone who has turned 100 or is about to turn 100, Mr. Mike Gurgit.
Indeed. I mean, talk about a legend in the wine world. I've had the pleasure of knowing Mike and hanging out with him many times, and he is and continues to be at 100 years old. I had this pretty luminous persona, very funny, very active in the wine world. And I mean, you could call him the godfather of Napa wine in some ways. And I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah.
He's quite jovial and fun. And yeah, pretty crazy, 100 years old. And I guess the secret is good wine and friends. So he says, one thing he always mentions is, every day I make a friend. And I mean, that has to be part of his secret.
I believe that because Gergich Hills reached out to me a couple weeks ago because they're basically celebrating his birthday for like an entire month. And there's all of these events that are happening and huge parties. And I'm sure you'll be there.
I wanted to share a story about Mike, actually, which I always kind of sears in my brain. So when he came as a young man from Croatia, he started working with Robert Mondavi, and that's where he got his start, right? But he used to ride the bus from Napa to Oakville, and being a very, very humble, with no money, basically, but driven by passion, he would take the bus and look at this vineyard past Yonville on the right every day. And he always said, one day I would love to, and I will own that vineyard. And eventually, a few decades later, when he started his project on his own and so on and so forth, he ended up buying that vineyard. So whether you ride a bike or ride the car towards dinner or go to Santa Elena or whatnot, when you look at the right, you'll see a little old house and a beautiful vineyard basically across the street from Domino's. And I always think about him that way.
I think maybe what people don't know is that, you know, he was living in communist Yugoslavia in the 1950s and made his way to Napa, and not only made his way to Napa, which was extraordinary in and of itself, but then proceeded, as you said, to buy a vineyard. In between there, he was the winemaker for the very famous 1976 Judgment of Paris, but it was the 73 Chateau Montalina Chardonnay. I'm so excited that we get to celebrate because I think as a wine professional and student of wine in Napa Valley, it's so, you know, we don't get to meet, you know, these people that helped to put us in the map. Certainly Robert Mondavi is gone. A lot of other legends are gone, but I'm really excited to celebrate his 100th birthday. Last but not least, I didn't even know this was happening, Eduardo. Did you know that there is maybe going to be a new AVA in Napa Valley?
It came out of nowhere.
Right?
It does make sense, but
yes,
I'm all about it because it does capture a certain part of the Napa Valley that it, you could say through blind tastings and such. It is different. Those wines definitely evoke a slightly different terroir. Hey, why not?
Why not? I had the same reaction to you. And if you're lost as to what we're talking about, there is a new potential AVA coming to Napa Valley. That's an American viticultural area for those of you trying to learn something about wine. These are these little designated areas that we have all up and down the United States and, of course, in California and Napa. So you've got Oakville, Yountville, Howell Mountain, which I think is the one that we're sort of calling into question right now. And now they're trying to propose a new AVA called the Crystal Springs AVA that encompasses the lower portion of Howell Mountain that's above the valley floor in St. Helena but doesn't meet the 1,400-foot elevation requirement. So you have like all of these vineyards that kind of like live in no man's land that have to claim the wider Napa Valley appellation, even though they're vineyard-specific. And when we talk about quality of wine and quality of fruit sources, usually we say like the more specific you can be on a label, the better. It's not always the case. And we're definitely going to talk about that with the wine that we have today. But I think it's sort of been this sort of like unfair thing that these vineyards, you've got Burgess there, Viadere has been there forever. I don't know if CV is going to be part of that because they've always been like just under that 1400 threshold. But you have all these vineyards that live in this like no man's land that don't meet that 1400 foot requirement that have had to claim this Napa Valley appellation instead of something more specific. And now they're looking at hopefully getting this new subregion approved by the TTB. And it looks like it could happen as early as like the next like month or so.
Crazy fast in the process. So I was just through Europe, and to get a new part of a recognized area, it can take over 5-10 years. But here we move quick. I mean, when there's a drive, it's amazing to see.
Steph, are you, when you look at like wines, and I know you mentioned you're more into like natural wines, like do you look at locations? Is that important to you on the label?
I think for learning purposes, yes. So, you know, I'm more knowledgeable. And I also realize, you know, you have to know your canon in order to expand it. But that being said, I think for me, I do look at wine a lot differently. Number one, it has to go with the food. Mm. And I try to find wines that are a little bit less known, just so it expands the table and winemakers and different ways of making wine and different missions. But what I prefer serving, I'd like to know, you know, like if it's a blend, I want to, like, you know, if it's a GSM in California, mm-hmm. I do want to know what areas. I'm just so for my own edification.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And just to learn. But otherwise, you know, if it tastes good and it's really wonderful and a good story is so important. I think, like, you know, just hearing about Mike, I want to go taste it. And just like, just hearing about how things come to fruition, how it's made, you know, I think it's all really important. And I love blends. So thank you for choosing a blend.
Yes.
For me, like I blend and I compose and I feel like not every year something tastes the same. Mm-hmm. And really expressing the best of it is really important to me. And I think blending allows you to kind of play with certain flavors and certain, I like to call them materials a little differently.
I think we're about to have a really fun conversation about wine.
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, I just hearing from you both, you know, the last few minutes, I'm learning so much. You know, sometimes like you get so overwhelmed with information that you're like, I only want the latest and greatest and keep up, you know, not have FOMO with what everyone else is talking about. But I think all of what we do has such a canon and revisiting those canons are really important.
There's so much to do. I love your spirit. Speaking of your spirit and enthusiasm, we are going to be talking about a review. Because this is the time in the show that we ask you to pause the show, leave us a review, preferably the 5-star kind. And I'm going to read one right now. And this is from M. Velasco 07. It's a 5-star one. Those are our preferred kind. And it says, love this show. I appreciate the variety of episodes, the super practical takeaways, and the sincere humility of Amanda and Vanessa to give all of this amazing knowledge to their listeners for free. You're right. It is for free. This whole show is for free. And we love sharing our knowledge with you. We love being here with you every other week, both on YouTube and in podcast form. And if you are enjoying this, that's a really great way you can support us. The other great way you can support us is by joining the Wine Access Unfiltered Wine Club. We've got a wine to drink from this episode coming up. And if you want to drink it with us, with me and Eduardo and Chef, then you should be a part of this wine club. It is a bi-monthly subscription. All of the information is below. Get into it. We have so much fun selecting these wines, and we do select them for our guests, for ourselves, and of course, for the topic that we're talking about. So without any further ado, let's get into the episode. See you in a second. All right, you guys, we are back. And before I jump into this wine, I just want to call attention to something. I was about to open this bottle of wine that we have here. This is the Benevolent Neglect GSM Grenache Syrah Mourvèdre. I noticed as I was about to open this bottle, yes, everyone has, show your bottle.
Oh, it's an amazing piece of art.
It is a piece of art. It's got this little like wax capsule on the top of it. It's just a small one. And I think for some people, it's a little intimidating because you're like, I don't know what to do with that. Where's the cork? Where's the foil, right? So here's what you're going to do. You can do one of two things. One, you can just take like your knife and just like flick that thing off. Usually it comes right off. The other thing that you can and probably should do is just go in with your corkscrew right into the top. And you can just dig right into it and pull the cork, pull the whole thing out as if it's like not even there. Can you hear it squeaking? I love that squeaky sound. Mm-hmm. Eduardo, this is an Eduardo special, right? This is a wine that you found.
It is. Actually, it's a long story. But long story short, this is made by two friends of mine that I'm very lucky to consider friends. When I first met them, I was running the program at Morimoto and I was here in Napa. And Ben Brenner, who's one of the partners, walked in with a bottle of Syrah, which was their first release. It's Las Madres Syrah from Carneros. And he said, hey, just made this. It's been bottled recently. This is our first vintage. Do you want to try it? And he pops the bottle. We tasted it. And I was impressed. I'm a huge Syrah lover and Rhone varietals. And this one captured the essence. And not to mention also the packaging and everything. So he poured me a glass. He said, we have only so many cases. I believe it was like 100 cases, right? And I said, sign me up. And since then, it's been on my list and every other list when we, in every other properties when we could. Recently, they just opened a tasting room downtown Napa a couple months ago.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
It is a cool spot you got to visit. They have DJs, they have partnerships and pop-ups. So last time I went, I took part of the Wine Access team across departments. And we were hanging out and they popped a bottle of this GSM. This is probably in December or so. And I was impressed. They popped it and I said, what's going on with this? How much did you produce? We would love to feature it. And then later when we found out that we were going to partner with you, Chefman, we just locked it up.
I actually remember getting the message from you, Eduardo. Whenever we're selecting these wines, where you know we kind of go back and forth, there's a lot of conversation that happens, a lot of tasting that happens. And I remember this was the very first wine that you guys brought forward to me as a possibility. And I was like, slam dunk, let's do it.
Bam.
So excited that like we even got this allocation for the club. So huge thanks to you, Eduardo, because this wine has been featured at some very, very important restaurants. Speaking of important restaurants, we've got Chef Manfon with us, and you have arguably one of the most important restaurants in all of LA. But before we talk about that, a really interesting story. Your parents immigrated to the US from Vietnam. You honed your craft as the chef at Beechwood Cafe in Hollywood. And then you started doing pop-ups in late 2013, which I'm trying to go back to like 10 years ago. I don't recall there being a lot of pop-ups in this era. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I just like wasn't in on it. But you gained local fame for porridge and puffs in Filipino town in Los Angeles. But then you open this restaurant called Fennekite, which has a Michelin star. Los Angeles Times named it their restaurant of the year, and yet it has no permanent location.
I come from fine dining. It's a fourth, fifth career as a Gen Xer. You know, I changed my majors in college a lot. I just believe in a lot of fluidity. I think you just throughout life, you collect experiences and tools. Before now, it's like, you know, I think I was the very first generation where people would really get scared that you didn't plan on staying at a job for more than a year. Mm. And I would, you know, I really loved it. You know, I was being in LA and being in film.
Was that your first introduction to LA through the film?
My parents are originally from Wausau, Wisconsin, from Vietnam. And then they moved to Los Angeles in the 70s. And then I grew up, you know, I grew up in LA. I'm an Angeleno. And then I went to college, came back, love films, always love films. But my parents wanted me to have a real job, like be a doctor or a lawyer. Yeah, I went down that route for a little bit, you know, to law school up at Berkeley and didn't really, it wasn't for me. So I dropped out. Came back, you know, I'm just like, I'm just going to watch a lot of films and, you know, work. There's a little studio called Gramercy Pictures and just really try to understand how to communicate to others, you know, to love films as much as I do. Some people call that marketing. For me, it's sharing my love. Mm-hmm. I've always done that. I've always shared my love of whatever I love and whatever I've created. So all of this to say, you know, being in the culinary world, the film world, the art world, to me, it's all the same quote unquote job and career. Mm. It's really being a practitioner of a craft, becoming really good at it. So you understand the canon, you understand the technique, you understand how you can contribute to that canon, and then sharing it with others.
I think, well, and I think that, you know, this idea of chef is so closely related to arts and all of these other things that, you know, even as somms in the wine industry, I think like we love to paint outside the lines. We love to work in lots of different places. I think even this podcast sort of suggests the fact that like wine can cross over into lots of other things because it is so fluid. And I think that your cuisine and your style of cooking has definitely lent itself to this idea of fluidity. But I want to talk a little bit about this idea of Asian flavors. And we are not going to paint this picture of like what Asian flavors are, but like, you know, there's so many regional differences. So it's impossible to come up with a hard and fast definition. But what are the things that separate Asian cuisine from the rest of the world if we were to go down that rabbit hole?
I think one should look at what one's mom feeds them as an Asian person. And then to look at a culture is to see what they ferment and what their main grain and their main source of protein is. For us, for a lot of Asian, I'm talking about, you know, East Asian countries and Southeast Asian countries, the main grain is rice. And then for a seasoning, instead of salt, there's also fish sauce and soy sauce. Mm-hmm. So those just kind of giving that baseline rice and soy and the sauce and, you know, and fish, it's a little different than how Europeans do. And in fact, fat's very different also, right? We don't use as much. We use some pork fat, some meat fat, but we don't have a lot of butter. Because we don't use cows in the same way, right? Of course, we had colonizers and, you know, visitors come in and bring stuff. And we learned those techniques and it's incorporated into the culture, which I don't begrudge. You know, I begrudge colonization, but I don't begrudge the outcome of what it's done for food. And I really think about that a lot. I'm anti-colonial practices because I don't think anyone should take over any culture or appropriate any culture. However, I can't decolonize what's done in the past. Being a Vietnamese person, I love banh mi and I love the wheat that was, you know, brought seeded to Vietnam and, you know, what came about it. I love pho, you know, like, you know, people have been cooking pho for a long time, but what gave it its prominent taste is the way it's done, like a consommé. Very, you know, the technique and the art of having a very clear pho is very, it's very Vietnamese versus one that's emulsified, which I also love, like a tonkotsu, which is emulsified and the bones are just shaken up so it's creamy. Two very different things.
You know, you mentioned a lack of fat, right? Or at least like dairy fat when we're talking about butter. spices, of course, fall into their, you know, the using wheat in some instances. But I think there's also this notion of sweetness that maybe doesn't exist so much in other cuisines that really plays a part in a lot of regional cuisines within Asia, especially when we talk about, you know, Eastern Asian cuisines. And I think that to me has always made it so fun, but also so intimidating when you're taught as a wine professional to only work within your salt, fat, acid, or heat. You know, sweet is not a part of the equation when you're taught food and wine pairing 101. But it's so fun when it is brought into the equation and when it is a part of all of the different things that you're trying to work with. So how do you see sweetness as part of your cooking, if at all?
I always tell my team, our savory food should have a bit of sweetness and our sweet food should have a bit of savoriness. Mm. You know, they're actually balanced. If we were to have a spectrum, I think there should always be balance. Yeah. And I think our acid level is different and texture is really important in Asian food. Super important texture. And I think wine and texture is something that we don't talk about it a lot. But for me, it's texture is really important. If you have a tempura or something fried, like you really need a wine that can stand up to not only the fat, but that texture, right? And if you have something soft and cuddly, like a porridge, which we do, we have a porridge house. Having a wine, you know, like red wine can stand up to like any porridge, which people don't think about, you know, but it's because it's so comforting and it hugs you and it sticks to your bones. This wine can stand up to it, but you can also have a, you know, you can also have a more acidic, lighter wine that can contrast that. But, and our acid levels are very different too. Wines are really special on each sip because when I compose a dish, even the most humbling porridge dish, which is, you know, a restaurant, I make sure that each bite is different, right? Everyone has an ability to create a different bite in their composed plate. Mm. So there's a lot of components that you can play with, a savory, an acidic, a sweet, a bright, a very comforting, you know, more neutral and more umami. And I feel like wine with each sip is the same way. Even just this wine alone, like, you know, I'm tasting it. It's like there's certain sips that are so California and there's certain sips that's like so Rhone that it takes me back, you know?
So with Vietnamese food in particular and a little bit of Eastern Asian in general, usually a safe place is Riesling, right? Alsatian Riesling to say something because of the heat.
Eduardo, I'm so glad that you said that because I walked into this podcast and I was like, are we really doing an episode on Asian cuisine and not bringing Riesling?
No,
then
Riesling.
I was like, this is actually really refreshing because I've talked about this a lot. Continue. Sorry.
Yeah, it's amazing. So it's your instant go-to. It's like saying sushi and sake, right? Oh, it's a comfortable place.
Yeah.
But when you throw something, a wine like this that has the extra layers, a little bit of faint of like Darjeeling tea and a little bit of like fresh fruit and all the balance. Oh my God. I mean, the opportunities and expressions are endless, especially when you have balance, as you mentioned, whether it's a pho and you have enough heat in there, you throw some jalapenos and then you put some hoisin style sauce that gives a little depth and the meat. Oh my God. The pairing, I think it's just my mouth's watering. Excuse me. Things like that definitely capture the heat, sweetness, savory texture, crunchy little parts, or like porridge. Oh my God. I could sit back with a porridge with like crunchy, like crispy onions and things like that just kind of popping up. And a wine like this, unbeknown to a lot of people that just immediately put things side and side, wow, it just it's a discovery, which is something I really love about the food and wine marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely would serve this with pho. I would definitely serve this with the porridge, especially if it had like a savory, sweet soy sauce, because the nuttiness and the caramelization will bring it out. And I think my advantage, you know, with our food is my ingredients come from California. So some of the terroirs already shared, right? But something that's gingery will stand up really well with this. I love Asian food with red wine. You know, I love kind of freaking people out serving red wine and fish, but I do it all the time.
Absolutely. It breaks down the barrier.
Are you doing wine pairings at Fennekite?
We do. We do pairings, but you know, we use the smaller, the better is kind of our philosophy. Like, we get a lot of unintended orange wines and I kind of laugh. And it's like, it's kind of like this funny reputation. And I'm like, and I'll tell people, I'm like, I think it's a little funky, but just taste it with this, you know? And I think, and things, and it's, I am one of those people. I understand the canon and I understand what people are going for, but I also, for environmental practices, I'm like, wait, is that a second pressing? Is that a piquette? Like, give it to me. Let me figure this out. Because I drink these wines and I'm like, no, don't waste it. And they're like, all the wines got smoke in it. I'm like, okay, I want to tell a story about this. But like, I don't know. It's just like, everyone hates me on this. And they're like, because Asian food, let's say Asian food decades ago in the United States, people were afraid of MSG. People were afraid of fish sauce. And then it's just like looking at these flavors. I'm like, no, maybe we need to expand our palate. And I think for me, like not having waste and finding ways to use things is really important. And I think, why can't that expand our canon a little bit? Just like, yes, this is, you know, a 1,000-year-old, you know, from France, from the Rhone, you know, Valley, from Bordeaux. Like, yes, know that if you have that opportunity and that privilege, just so you know that what the world standard and what, you know, the 97s and 100s, what they're quote unquote grading it on, but find your own voice. And I've done that.
And I think it's important to have voices of dissent in the wine world. I think it's important that we don't all agree on everything. Like, are there benchmarks? Sure. Have they been around for hundreds of years? Probably. Are there going to be other wines that change the game for us down the line in the way that we've seen food evolve and the way that we've seen chefs evolve and even restaurants and the styles of restaurants evolve? Absolutely. And I think it's appropriate that your wines on your list would reflect that. It wouldn't make sense to have all traditional things because you're not traditional. You color outside the lines. You're working outside the norms and the traditions of everything from food to wine. So, you know, why wouldn't you be interested in an orange wine that maybe it did see a little bit of smoke? All right, let's play with it. Let's see what we can do with that, because I don't think it's all always a loss. Like, there's beauty in everything. Everything is an art. Someone took time to make that. So let's find the beauty in there.
Totally. And I think it also gives like a certain sense of, expands the table and gives some accessibility. Because if we're just all here just tasting Margaux from one year to another, number one, who can afford that except for like less than 1% of the world, right? And then number two, it's like, if that's all you're tasting, then you're not expanding the table for others. But that doesn't make me any less appreciative when I taste something that I'm like, okay, I close my eyes, I totally get why this is so amazing, and a little teardrop zone. I'm like, I get it. Yes. It's really special.
We're getting down to our last few minutes, so I want to ask you a few questions from the audience. I think this will be an interesting one to ask you. What is the best wine to drink with Vietnamese food? And I will say that like Wine Access does such a great job of putting, you know, giving you the search filter to be able to like put in a food pairing and see the wines. But I don't know, after this conversation, like, do you think there is such a thing as like, you know, the best wine to drink with Vietnamese food?
Just for clarification, I don't cook Vietnamese food. I cook California food, right?
True.
So, I mean, and then, but if my mom's cooking, you know, we open all kinds of wine and they all go well together. So I think it just depends on what it is. I think there's no general wine. You know, yeah, you know, are most of the wines on our pairings white or orange? Yes. Are they like, do we only have one red? Correct. We only have one red. So because we're more seafood and plant intensive, those lighter flavors are a little bit better, but it just depends on whatever you like.
I think the moral of this story and across all these episodes is like, drink what you like with what you like. There is no wrong or right way to do this. There are 101 pairings, but color outside lines. Have a little fun. Don't be afraid to experiment a little bit. We're asking all of our chefs this because they're all living in such great food cities. And of course, LA is definitely one of them. Where are some of your favorite places to eat, chef?
A restaurant inside a Barcade called Poltergeist. The chef there is named Chef Diego. He's cooked all over town. And I really love that place because he really explores LA. He writes a love letter to LA that makes me fall in love with LA more. Because like the way I describe our cuisine is a love letter to LA and California. And he does the same thing. And so we find these nooks and crannies of flavors that only exist in LA because of the people, the cultures. And I think he's doing a really great job, you know, coaxing these flavors and presenting and expressing himself via these flavors. But then I also love, you know, I think I love restaurants when my friends open them because I just love celebrating the people behind the food. Of course, I love regions of LA, the SGV, really, you know, for Asian foods and mom and pop shops. I really love mom and pop shops. I think they're a dying art. You know, and I understand why. It's kind of like small farmers. They're a dying art. So anytime you can support a mom and pop, you know, go to it.
I can't wait to get back down to LA and hopefully get a seat at the elusive Fennekite and the very famous Fennekite. Eduardo, what a pleasure to have you on with us today. So happy we could connect in this way. And thank you for bringing the Benevolent Neglect GSM to the table. If you all want to drink with us in future episodes, you can do so by joining the Wine Access Unfiltered Podcast Wine Club. Of course, be sure to subscribe to this podcast, like it, review it, do all the things that help us. And that will ensure that we can continue bringing more great conversations like this one to the table. Thanks so much, and we'll see you soon. Bye.
Cheers.
An honor. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.